Exton Moss Experiment. Adventures in Wine and Space with Simon Exton and Ken Moss. Hello everyone, and a very warm welcome to another edition of the Exton Moss Experiment. I'm Ken Moss.
I'm Simon Exton.
Dr. Exton, what are we watching tonight?
Tonight, we are going to be watching three episodes of the 1960s spy anthology Espionage. This was a series of plays transmitted between 1963 and 1964. They've had a beautiful DVD release by Network, and it features three plays that were directed by Michael Powell. They're an interesting group of plays because there is some what you think of as classic espionage-type stories, but there's also some more unusual ones. So ones featuring Benjamin Franklin and Samuel Johnson, or ones round about the Irish Easter Uprising in 1916. They're well played. They're well written. They're very entertaining. They attracted some really, really good guest cast. So the likes of Sean Phillips, Dennis Hopper, Patrick Troughton, Barry Foster, Roger Delgado, all excellent people. And pretty much without exception, a very entertaining and well done watch.
Well, as with so many things, I am completely ignorant of this, so I'm looking forward to 3 hours of archivey goodness. But before then, I think we need a drinky. It's time to get out the tonic screwdriver and open up the gin bottle. Tonight we are drinking Edinburgh Classic Gin. It's a small batched distilled gin made in Scotland. It's 43%. And the info bollock says, distilled in the shadow of Edinburgh Castle, this gin is crafted from the finest quality grain spirit with a unique blend of Scottish botanicals. A classic gin with a citrusy nose, a subtle hint of heather and a burst of juniper. Best enjoyed as a classic gin and tonic with a zesty orange twist. Well, as ever, we're just having it with Indian tonic and a cube or two of ice. And there's a lovely louche, a whisper of a micro louche, as you might say.
Oh, you can smell the citrus.
Oh, you can smell the Scottish.
Yes.
The Scottish gins have a very definite smell. So, oh, you English bastard, dive in and taste me.
A smell of sporrans. Oh, I'm kind of surprised that didn't come out of your nose. That was a joy to watch.
Pow.
That's very Scottish.
It's very Scottish. I'm getting heather out of that, actually.
Yes. It's quite bitter, but it's a nice bitter. It lingers on your tongue.
Well, it is mixed at Exton strength.
Of course.
Which is slightly stronger than your average gin measure.
But only slightly.
Only slightly. 50-50.
50-50.
50-50. I like that a lot.
I think this is lovely.
Yeah.
5 out of 5.
I think it's going to have to be a 5. Yeah, 5 out of 5. That's a really, really nice gin. I'll tell you what it puts me in mind of. I do keep coming back to this. Do you remember the Asda premium gin? It's a real taste to it.
But the bite of this is more like a bear trap than Asda's mouse trap.
To be fair, yes. But I like beige gins that have got this sort of taste. I mean, to be fair, I'm very reluctant to call that a beige gin because it's got so much going on in there. There's certainly heathers and sort of Scottish flavours and a piney notes and all that sort of thing going on. That's lovely. That's really lovely. So grab your glass and we shall descend into the under gallery here at Podcasting House and open up the Black Archive. I'm going to rescue that absolute classic of sitcoms, Mind Your Language, Series 4. Now, Mind Your Language was a British sitcom, I think there's an H missing out of that, that premiered on ITV in 1977. There were three series by London Weekend Television between 1977 and 1979, and for some reason they brought it back in 1985 with 6 of the original cast. It was fairly terrible. We have done Mind Your Language for a previous episode. It was one of our Brexit episodes. We watched the pilot episode and it was
awful.
Fairly bad, yes.
I mean, not the worst thing that we've seen.
Oh, not by a long way, but it was... I don't know how they managed to stretch that out to three series and then bring it back. So apparently there are no copies. There's some fairly ropey off-air copies of certain episodes of Series 4. But it's just one of those things it's lost. So it's a gap. I don't like gaps. We'll have that back. What about yourself?
Well, I think I would like to stick with the espionage theme and bring back something spy-ish. And the thing that I would like to bring back is an early 1960s spy drama called The Rat Catchers.
Oh, dear God.
We've seen an episode of this, and it was very slow and very tedious. But reading around the other episodes and the overarching story, I think this is enemy of the world syndrome, in that we've seen a poor episode of what may well have been quite a good series. So I would like to be able to make that judgment.
Considering what I've just rescued, I don't think I'm in any position to criticise your choice.
It's never really stopped you in the past.
Or vice versa. So here we are, I'm back in the viewing room. It's time to put the disc in the player. Which is the first episode we're watching tonight?
We are going to start off by watching the episode from the 14th of December 1963 called Festival of Pawns, written by Raymond Bowers, from a story by Robert Dozier, and directed by James Shelton.
Without further ado, Ron VT.
Don't burden me with information I can't sell, Professor. I've contracted merely to export you. If Hartman has lied, then you will be rewarded for the information, and he will be punished.
I don't want that pay, you do.
He told them that under Hitler you had refused to risk experiment at all. That under Hitler, a continuance would have resulted in the senseless death of millions.
That is what I told him. An insane Götterdämmerung.
Your mistake, Professor, was to go into hiding. There was no evidence against you. Colonel Sprague, even, he came to convince you that you could stand trial without fear, particularly if you would then work for the West.
Okay, well, that was Festival of Pawns, an episode of espionage from 1963. It was Series 1, Episode 10. Dr. Axton, what the hell was that all about?
Well, that was a contemporary story set in East and West Germany, predominantly Western Germany. And you start off with a young woman swimming across a river to escape from the east to the west. And there is a platoon of guards who watch her go. And then as she's getting towards the western bank, start shooting and end up shooting her in the leg. She's rescued by an American patrol who then take her to see somebody in American intelligence who introduces her to a junior intelligence officer who is kind of there as a male honey trap, because the senior intelligence officer is convinced that this woman is an agent. The younger officer, it's quite odd. The whole first scene is, you're here because you're such a good tennis player and you should carry on with the tennis and you should get
you keep yourself in trim. Yeah. It's very homoerotic.
And gets more so as the episode goes on, because the woman is an agent. She is working under duress because her father, who is a scientist, is still in Russia. And so she's doing as she's told to keep him safe. The younger man, Bridger, goes to see her in her refugee camp, which is in Munich. And she is allowed to go out of the camp quite regularly to meet her fiancé, who's the intelligence officer that was seen on the eastern side of the river and the one that actually shot her in the arse, yes. And this is during the festival in Munich called Fasching, which is where apparently everybody is not what they seem and acts against type and wears masks. And the fiancé engineers a meeting at a local restaurant with Bridger. And the three of them spend lunch together. Bridger goes off with the girl for the afternoon, spends the afternoon together, and then they all meet up again for dinner. In the meantime, Ulrich, the East German intelligence officer, has gone to a different restaurant and talked to a waiter who turns out to be another German scientist working in disguise, who they want to persuade to go back to Russia and aiming to use Bridger as a way of getting across the border into Switzerland to make Bridger compliant. He threatens to kill the girl. So all four of them leave the restaurant in a car and drive towards the border, where they are all apprehended by the senior American intelligence officer.
The camp commandant.
Played by Sam Wanamaker, who basically says, we've known everything that's been going on all along, and what we wanted was the scientist that you wanted. Offers a deal to the East German agent to turn sides and return the girl's father so that he can work with his old colleague. Happy days, end of story.
All laugh, end credits.
Yeah. The use of the American soldier as a male honey trap was an interesting turn of tables.
Particularly since halfway through, a glance at IMDb revealed that Mr. Bridger, the actor whose name I have immediately forgotten, George
Grizzard,
was in real life partnered with William Tynan. The name has rung a bell before.
William Tynan?
Yes. The censor.
The censor was Kenneth Tynan.
Ah, right. It's in two different Tynans. I'm going to, first of all, come on
and
to
there's
the
a third one because there's Tynan Weir.
Get out. yes. The production values on this. First of all, the film print is excellent, and it is shot on film, and it's in fairly good nick. The sets are lovely. But
loads of outside filming.
I'm not convinced it was, you know. I am not convinced. I think they were just bloody good sets. Even the garden set, I'm not convinced.
Oh, the garden was, I thought, was a set.
Yeah, but obviously the river one, the river with some very dubious-looking water in it.
Yeah, it looked a bit manky. You'd not want to get shot while you're covered in that. I mean, you'd not want to get shot in the first place.
I can say I wouldn't want to be shot in the arse in the first place. But I think take it like a man. But I think the first thing that we both notice right from the off.
Actually, the very first thing I know, and I know what you're about to say, the very first thing I noticed was how good and dynamic the credits were. Because if you think about this, it's the same era of credits as early Avengers. And they're
fairly ropey. Yeah. But they were shot on video, and video is a much, much lower definition than film. The vision mixing is, in the days of 4 or 5 line, it was not good.
But there is no vision mixing in the Avengers, really, is there? It's just still image after still image after still image.
No, when you've got the credits, when the title of the episode flashes up, You are vision mixing. That's how you get.
Oh yeah, but what I'm talking about is the actual imagery of the credits itself, and this was.
Oh, I'm with you.
This was far more dynamic.
Gotcha. Yeah. Come on, we can't avoid the elephant in the room.
Well, there are two elephants in the room. One of them has a trumpet. The music.
Oh me, oh my. It's very Carry On, isn't it?
I don't generally notice background music because it's just there to. Accentuate what's going on. And I know the boys from the Peggy Mount Calamity Out will be gnashing their teeth at this because music is their bread and butter. But unless it's either exceptionally good or exceptionally jarring, I generally don't notice it. This was exceptionally jarring because you had big dramatic scenes with a Carry On soundtrack, romantic scenes with a brass band in the background.
You can take the mask off now, Professor.
It was monstrously overblown. We detracted badly from what was going on screen. I mean, to put this in context, it's an ITC production, isn't it? Mm. And with it being done on film, two American leads and there's quite a multicultural cast for the time. It's just, it feels filmic.
Yeah.
But the music just drags you out of it. Even the sort of the four acts that it's split into, the title of the thing, Espionage, da 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 da. It's really overblown, but the actual guts of the thing are quite good.
Yeah, and the episodes are, I mean, they've all got different settings from sort of oldie-timey London to China. It's not all contemporary espionage, but it's all intelligent, who's playing who, John le Carré style espionage, which jars with the brass band.
And then halfway through, when the restaurant, there's a parade goes by. Spoiler, it's stock footage, but it's the creepiest bloody parade I've ever seen. There's some great float with a huge dummy with a massive whacking great cigar coming out of the mouth, and an even bigger one with eyes that moved in a horrible... Where the hell did they find that footage?
I don't know, but it's probably a real festival.
Oh, it is. It clearly is.
The masks that they have are really quite odd. And do you know what they reminded me of?
Do I dare? Go on.
You know the scene in the abandoned theatre where Siri Van Epp and Phil Scrotty have that conversation with face masks on?
Yes.
In episode 2 of The Corridor People.
What was that? That well-known series, yes. Hmm.
That excellent series was what I think you meant to say. those sort of overblown masks kind of reminded me of that. The other thing I was going to say is for 1963, there were some very homoerotic themes. I mean,
it was right from the off, the very first conversation between the camp commandant Sprague and Bridger, wear your shorts, keep in trim. But even before that, there was something, it was very, very homoerotic.
Yeah, and then you get to the bit where later on Bridger suggests that it might be more appropriate for him to switch his investigation to the fiancé rather than Lena herself. And he just turns around and says, well, what sort of man are you? And it was a very arch comment.
Oh, it is.
And then later on, while they're all having dinner, and Bridger, he's had a bit to drink, and he's kind of flirting with Lena, and they're saying that during fashion, people forget who they are and what they are. And the East German agent looks direct at Bridger and says, I might just forget I have a fiancé.
The undertones are definitely there all the way through. I mean, that's not just me reading into it, because you've thought exactly the same thing, and we haven't discussed this while we were watching it. Yeah. But
and when they're in the park and Lena and Ulrich are having their meeting of agent and handler disguised as a romantic picnic. And
with a massive bottle of gin, which isn't gin.
But one of the couples in the background is two men having a picnic.
Oh, that I didn't see. Mm. I'd not clocked that.
For 1963, that's about as overt as it could be. I mean, it was post-Wolfenden, but it was 4 years before decriminalisation. It's around about the same time as the film Victim.
When was Italian Job? Because the whole Noel Coward thing, all that was...
Late 50s?
No, it's got to be 60s. Yeah, it's got to be 60s. But that was... I suspect there just came a point where... Because we've seen it a few times now where there's this... I say gay undertone, but it is there, where they've been very near the knuckle with how close they sail to the wind.
Well, I mean, Julian and Sandy in Round the Horn were pre-decriminalisation. I think by the 60s, the attitude was getting to be, well, we know these people are out there, so we don't mind seeing it on film, but actually not in my neighbourhood.
They've moved in next door, you know. There goes the neighbourhood. Come on, Miriam, we're leaving.
Overall, what did you think of Festival of Thorns?
I did enjoy it. The production values held that up. I think if it had been done standard techniques at the time, I think it might have been less than it was. Because story-wise, it wasn't the strongest story, but it was good to watch. And it all hung together very nicely. I did enjoy it, yes. Yeah. I'm glad we're watching more.
I enjoyed it. I thought it was a bit slow. I thought some of the acting was quite wooden.
Mm.
Bridger really wasn't a good actor.
No, but he was really the butt of the joke, but he was the underdog the whole way through. He was the character that thought he was into control, but actually he was being played by everybody else.
Yeah, but when he was looking as though he was trying to do the seduction of Lena, it really wasn't convincing at all. Now, whether he was playing the part well and it was supposed to look as though it wasn't convincing because he wasn't convinced himself and the character was an upright character, or... Perhaps it's the character was played as not being particularly interested in women, and therefore he was trying to force himself. The pacing was slow. Mm. Music jarred. It looked beautiful. I think it was quite a good story that was just dragged out a bit.
I was surprised it was in four acts, because most of the TV we watched from this period is in three. They were slightly shorter. They were 12 or 13-minute acts, but even so, that was surprising. I'll be interested to see if they carry on the musical motif. What are we watching next? What's the next one up?
The next one up is an episode from the 4th of January 1964 called Never Turn Your Back on a Friend.
Ron VT.
Anaconda, that dilemma I said we had to talk about, I think it ought to be now.
Shoot.
Well, I want all three of us to get the credit for capturing this chap, but...
But you don't think all three governments should share him and his Big Bang machine?
I don't think the Russians should share.
How do you figure on stopping him?
I'm going to dump Tavarich. You can do exactly what you like when the time comes. I just felt you had a right to know, that's all.
What are they doing out there? Talking together, duh. Making some plan.
They make a deal with you, huh? To leave me out of it. Come answer me.
Not my idea, I swear.
Not my idea. Who's idea then? Whose? Tell me, you pig, or I kill you. Then nobody gets you.
No, better still. No, I cut you in three pieces.
Bye-bye!
Give me that knife.
Okay, what have we just watched?
Right, we have just watched the episode Never Turn Your Back on a Friend. This time it was a, rather than a contemporary Cold War story, it was a story set during the Second World War and set in occupied Norway. And a trio of agents who are used to working together, a British agent, an American agent, and a Russian agent, are sent in, assisted by a local school teacher, to blow up the local hydroelectric plant, which they managed to do very effectively. Coming back to rendezvous at the schoolhouse, the British agent discovers a German scientist, believes that he is important, and brings him back to the schoolhouse. The three of them argue about whether to keep the scientist alive, and the schoolmistress managed to get a message back to London saying who the scientist is, and the message comes back that it's absolutely imperative that he is brought back with them so that he can continue working for the Allies. The four of them spend a very tense night in the schoolhouse, and cracks start to appear in the friendship, particularly with the Russian, and this continues once they get to the scientist's laboratory to pack up all his stuff. While they're there, the scientist is able to talk privately with both the British agent and the Russian agent. First off, saying to the British agent, if there's any choice, I want to come and work for Britain. And then saying to the Russian agent, the British agent is forcing me to come back and work for Britain. So trying to play both ends against the middle. The two agents fight, the British and the Russian one, and the Russian kills the British agent. The Russian and American agent then escape with the scientist to go and rendezvous with the plane. And each one suggests that the other defects to their country, the American to come back to Russia, the Russian to come to America. And both say not to do that. They get to the plane, the Russian escorting the scientist, the American carrying his papers, throws the papers at the Russian to knock him off guard, tries to take the scientist onto the plane, shoots down the Russian but doesn't kill him. The scientist gets onto the plane, the Russian shoots down the American, and the last thing you see is the plane taking off. The Norwegian schoolmistress with the body of the dead American, and the Russian trying to rescue as much of the paperwork as he can, while he's also staggering about having been shot. I thought this was a real ramp-up in quality.
In many ways, certainly, yeah.
The performances of all of the actors were superb, but particularly the British agent played by Mark Eden and the Russian agent played by Julian Glover were brilliant. It was very well written. It was incredibly well directed. And this is one of the episodes directed by Michael Powell.
What do we know him from?
He was an Oscar winner for The Red Shoes, I think. But he's a well-known film director.
I did notice in the credits as well, Morris Binder or Binder. He did some of the composite shots and the special effects. Mm. And he was responsible for the vast majority of the James Bond title sequences. So all that imagery was... more espionage, but there were a lot of very nice little pieces in it. Even right towards the start, when there's an explosion near the schoolhouse, and it's clearly a set, but the curtains blow in and the lampshades are swinging, and the schoolmistress looks out of the window, and there's a back projected shot, which is very well done.
Yep.
Of the burning background.
And there were nice big sets as well. I mean, that school set was really quite big, and it was one room moving into another.
Production-wise, this is, like you say, a real ramp-up, and it's from going to studio sets on film, this looks filmic, and there's some very definite outdoor shots as well, particularly, certainly at the end, But there's some of the scenes outside with the car driving around. Those are very definitely on location somewhere.
Yeah, and the laboratory set is very elaborate for something that's only used for a couple of scenes.
Yes. I was quite impressed by that. Mm. It was the only thing I think, I don't suppose there was really any way out of it, but the ending was a little bit, as you might put it, you've had your 50 minutes, goodbye. There was no ending, really. It was just everyone dies.
There was, and they'd been leading up to that ending since about halfway through the episode. So it wasn't suddenly this happens. There's a lot of action at the end, but everything's been leading up to it, and it ties it all together nicely. So for me, that's not the way it came across. There are a couple of comments that I would make. Firstly, the music's so much better. Vastly less intrusive.
Do you not think that it would have been better as it, you know,
carry-on soundtrack?
Carry on up the Second World War. Carry-on bombing.
I don't think it would. And I wish it had a different title. The title gave away what the theme of the episode was going to be. And the episode itself had a really nice build-up to it.
In fairness, yes.
All the Doctor Who stories of the Daleks, of the Cybermen. It gives away what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And it didn't detract from it that much, and it was still very good and very enjoyable. And compared to Festival of Pawns, where we were scribbling notes all the way through, I don't think either of us wrote a single thing on this.
No, I was delighted. It was a lovely surprise because I didn't know anything about this before. Mark Eden pops up midway through the first scene. It's the second thing this week, I think, we've watched with Mark Eden in. First and foremost, we both know him from Doctor Who, Marco Polo. But he's excellent in whatever he is in. And Julian Glover's another of that stable of actors. Again, it's that they started in theatre. And it's a different style of acting. It's far more expressive. And that's all you really had in the 60s was theatre actors who'd got into television. And I've got to be honest, I prefer that in many ways. There's a gravitas to the performances in many cases that you don't get nowadays.
Yeah, and these were all powerful performances. The American is a bit backgroundy by comparison, but it's only by comparison to two really superb performances.
The question I keep meaning to ask about this is, do we think that because we have subsequently gone to see these actors in lots and lots of other things, and therefore we attribute more weight to them, or are they pushing everyone else into the background by default?
I could think that about Julian Glover. I don't think I've seen Mark Eden in a huge number of things around that time. I know we've seen him in that Avengers episode recently, and he was at, was he Coronation Street?
Coronation Street. He was a real badass in that.
That was after I'd been watching Coronation Street. So he's a name I know. Obviously, I haven't seen Marco Polo, and I'm not actually that wildly keen on the audio.
Oh, we have different views on Marco Polo. I suspect, actually, I've sung the praise of... Marco Polo is the fourth ever Doctor Who story, and it's missing. It's the earliest missing Doctor Who story. The audio survives, and it's a great 7-episode, big sprawling adventure, lots of characters, lots of locations. It's possible if it did turn up, it might not live up to the visuals in my head.
Or it might, because it's not just visuals in your head. We've got telesnaps for quite a lot of it, so we kind of know what it's going to look like. I suspect it's one where you can't do an Aztecs and just power through all 4 episodes. You're going to need to do a War Games and watch it 1 or 2 at a time.
Oh, much as I love it, even I can't do all 7 episodes at once. It's too much.
Mm.
But yeah, Mark Eden plays Marco Polo in that, and he's wonderful. Even the audio performance is wonderful. Moving on with, or getting back to... A Man for Emily. No, turn your back on your friends. What? Where the hell did that come from? It was a totally different thing. I mean, this is clearly an anthology series. Every episode is a play, and yes. they're even listed on the DVD as, you know, select your play. And the idea running through it that they're all spy dramas or espionage dramas, but unconnected, it gives a wonderful free reign, really, to the format between stories. And, well, the sleeve notes for the DVD set say that it's one of the lesser known and more sought after ITC productions. I've never heard of this before, but I take it you're familiar with this.
I've seen all of them.
Yeah.
Years ago when the DVD first came out, and I can't remember a bad one. Never Turn Your Back on Your Friend, when I watched it, stood out as a particularly good one. I really enjoyed it.
I've got to admit that I enjoyed that more than the last one, certainly. That was, it was a, again, even though the first one was a little bit, you know, carry on farcing, it was, production wise, they are very filmic. Because some of these are American, and the, I think the teacher really was Norwegian. The professor, he was not English, putting on an accent. Not with a name like that, whatever it was. But the fact that they've gone the extra mile with the cast, I do think makes a difference. We've seen plenty of
examples. George Vaskovec.
That's the bunny. What we get with things like this is English actors putting on foreign accents.
Bonjour, old chap.
Gut and tag, old fruity. Not terribly convincing. Shot on video in very obvious studio sets. With these, they're all done on film in a mix of very good sets and locations with international actors, and the English ones are of very good quality. So you've got this filmic feel to a series. It probably didn't actually have that much money spent on it, but it feels like it did.
I think it did, because in the sleeve notes it says that one of the episodes was filmed entirely in New York.
Is that the one we're going to do next?
No.
Oh, fair enough. What are we going to do next?
We're going to do another one of the Michael Powell ones, because that last one was directed absolutely.
It was.
And also because of the cast in this. It's the episode from the 21st of March, 1964. It's the 23rd episode out of 24 called A Free Agent, starring Anthony Quayle and Sean Phillips.
Good grief. Right. Ron VT.
Have you been listening to a word I've been saying?
Oh, yeah. Been going in one ear and out the other. Go ahead. You were giving me your considered opinion of my wife.
Well, it's the Chiefs, too. Cruel enough to think that I can reason with you. We were his prize team for a long time.
Far too long.
Long enough to know that I don't enjoy showing you these.
Oh, what a nice picture.
It was taken the day you and Anna left Berlin. You separated, made your own ways to the frontier. Good security. But what does Madame do the moment she's free of you? She reports to the boss. Now why?
I trust Anna couldn't take care. It's as simple as that.
Then will you explain to a fathead why she called on Peter? For a cup of tea?
Yeah, very likely. They drink a lot of the stuff.
You're in trouble, mate. If I were you, I'd get on the first plane back to England, with or without Anna, before you end up in a Moscow hospital.
Okay, well, that was Espionage, A Free Agent, from
1964.
And it was bloody good, wasn't it?
It was. It's another one directed by Michael Powell. And you can see how good a director he is. Exactly the same was with the previous one. It was another 1960s contemporary story, and it starred the two leads as agents. Anthony Quayle was playing a British agent. Sean Phillips was playing a Russian agent who had got married against the orders of their bosses and had gone to Switzerland, where he used to live, to set up home in a neutral country. And while they're there, both of their old handlers turn up and try and interfere with the marriage. Initially, this just makes them hang on to each other more, but then doubts start to creep in, and she makes the decision to go back to Moscow because she thinks that he's starting to have doubts. He offers to go to Moscow with her, and she says that you'll just be tortured for all the information that you can get, and she walks out. Before she walks out, she says that she was ordered to marry him to try and persuade him back to Moscow, and that even her handler didn't know about it. She leaves. He goes back to the hotel room to see his Swiss friend, the association and friendship with whom is part of the reason that he set up there, and admits that he was also under orders to marry her, gain her trust, go back to Moscow to seed false information. So it was possibly a more typical espionage thing than any of the others, in that it was all double cross and triple cross, and nobody really knowing exactly what the story was, apart from the two people who were initially acting under orders and then both decided to obey the orders and then...
Oops, this is for real.
Yep, and their handlers were doing what they thought was best, but hadn't been told what the actual situation was. That was really good.
That was on the edge, I'll be honest. Another horrible story of other people interfering and fucking up something really rather nice.
Or was it really something rather nice? Because
it could have been.
Both of them. Or would they have got sick of it inside a month when they didn't have orders to follow?
Who knows? But it seemed that they were genuinely happy married. And Both of the performances were superb, but they were, both of the performances were along the lines of, yes, I was following orders, and Anthony Quayle's only, his character only admits that after she's gone back to Moscow, but both of them were very much coming across that, you know, this was all a cover story. I don't feel anything at all for you. But in actual fact, yes, I don't want this to, you know, these horrible people have come back and ruined something, and now we've got doubts, and it must be over, darling, it must be over, I must away to Moscow, in a very RP Russian accent, I notice.
Well, I think it was only a few years after Brief Encounter, wasn't it? Wasn't that early 50s?
The plot itself, actually, is wafer thin. It's a very, very thin plot, dragged out over 50 minutes or an hour. It doesn't matter, because it was such a lovely thing to watch. They've clearly gone to somewhere like Switzerland or Austria to actually film the location scenes. This was not stock footage. This was actually done on location. There was a bit of back projection when they got off the train. It didn't quite work. You had two of them were in a studio, and the John Sessions, whoever it was, Max, he was on location. It didn't quite work.
And I don't understand why they did it quite like that, because later on in the scene, they were both there on the train station.
Oh, of course they were, yes. Yeah.
So yeah, I don't understand why that bit that was obviously, and I didn't think it was back projection. I thought it was a flat.
Oh, no, it looked, I could be wrong. Something was off with it either way.
But yeah, the bit where he just steps off the train and does the victory salute looks studio bound, whereas the rest of it doesn't. Although there isn't that jarring switch between film and videotape.
Yeah.
But it looked different. But later on in that location scene, you see all three of the principals there. They were all there to be able to do things like the ski lift sequence, and going out and walking through all the snow to get to the river to throw the wedding presents out. And the wedding presents that turn out to be completely innocuous.
Looking back, I'm not sure whether they were, or whether they were doubles. Because you see, the way it's filmed, I'm not sure you see any of them face on.
Yeah, you do.
Do you?
That bit where she's going on about, you know, he's saying, Whitehall don't do anti-personnel stuff. And she says, I've only been a British citizen for an hour. You have to forgive some distrust. And she takes the present from him and drops it.
Yeah, but that was on a set.
I think it was.
It was. That was indoors. When they were going through the house and they were picking all
No. She takes it from him and drops it directly into the river. It's just after she's thrown her present in, and he's debating about whether to throw his in, and she takes it off him and drops it in.
I'm questioning now, but again, that is down to the direction. It's the fact that we're now even questioning that is down to the skill of the direction. I thought that this was marvellous. It was really, really well done. As I say, a wafer-thin plot, but very well scripted, certainly very well acted. And for the fact that nothing really happens for that hour, it's basically a lot of...
Of suspicion and counter-suspicion and inference on very small bits of things, mainly that she notices. So
spilling the milk.
He spills the milk and goes, oh, well, oops. And she says, yeah, I've done that a load of times. With the inference being that he's done it deliberately because he doesn't trust her.
Mm.
And then the bit where he's bargaining for her and she says, it's very sweet of you to try and help my father, but he died 5 years ago. And again, the inference being, if you really cared, you'd actually have asked about that at some point.
It was heart-rending stuff. It was very, very skillfully written. Of the three that we've seen today, that's easily my favourite. You're going to go for the middle one, aren't
you? Yes, I am. Yeah.
I can see why. That's very much your stuff. But this, the emotional drama, I just thought was really skillfully done with, I'd say, very little effort. But it's...
The two leads, so Anthony Quayle and Sean Phillips, are the calibre of actors that can do that kind of thing while making it look as though there's very little effort. And it might be that for somebody their skill, it's not an awful lot of effort because they're just as good as they are.
Mm.
I suspect it was, and I suspect it was very carefully rehearsed beforehand and very carefully directed, and there's an awful lot of skill both in front of and behind the camera gone into making that.
Yeah.
And thank God they backplayed the music. Yes, if that had been the carry-on music from the
carry-on skiing.
That wouldn't have worked as well.
Yeah. That was a marvellous, marvellous bit of TV. If that's the calibre that they get up to with the rest of this series, I've got a lot to look forward to, because this is a 6-disc box set. There's a lot to go at.
Yeah, we've seen 3 out of 24.
Mm. That was our last episode for tonight, but you know more about this than I do. The rest of them, are they of the same sort of calibre? Did they get peaks and troughs?
They're all good. I mean, any show, you get peaks and troughs, and you get things that one person will prefer to another. I don't remember there being a bad one. I've picked ones that I remember being pretty good, or at least memorable.
I think you succeeded. They were smashing, yeah.
I've actually not picked any of the ones that have the slightly unusual locations. I think there's one in the Boxer Rebellion, there's one in the Irish Uprising, there's one around Samuel Pepys, I think.
Crikey, right.
Oh, there's some proper historical stuff in there as well. So possibly a volume 2 coming.
It could be, if we survive that long. My fellow Russian targets, we are recording this in February 2022.
2 days after the invasion of Ukraine.
When Vlad the Impaler Mark II is trying to carve up Ukraine in, oh, for whatever reasons, not as do. So if we survive long enough to edit this together, there's almost certainly going to be a part two. We've bumped up this recording schedule. A few things to do with Cold War and...
To be fair, this was always on the schedule for this weekend.
But a lot of things that we weren't going to
but
watch.
Other things.
Just while we've got the chance to watch them.
So expect a little mini-season around the theme of Cold War espionage, because it's kind of on our minds at the moment.
So to all our dear nuclear senders out there, thank you very much for listening. It has been our pleasure to talk to you. Hopefully your pleasure to listen to us. We'll be back next time with something, well, yeah.
Spy-ish.
Be afraid.
And
be very afraid.
In the meantime, search out your Protect and Survive leaflets and have another rewatch of Threads.
Game over, man. Game over.
Bye.
The Exton Moss Experiment featured Simon Exton and Ken Moss. All featured soundtracks are the property of their respective producers, and no infringement of copyright is intended. Title music was performed by the BBC Symphony Orchestra. And the program was produced by Maverick Productions. For more information, please visit maverickproductionsuk.blogspot.com or find us on social media.